Chapter 12. Undaya. Ever since he learned it was an alien influence possessing half a ship, Nathan tried to uncover some method of removing the invasive entities from the minds of those affected. He always thought identifying a problem was the first step to solving it. However, as Nathan stared at Lieutenant Charlotte Richmond lying on a biobed in sick bay, the doctor couldn't even imagine how to do this. He kept her sedated, hoping she would forgive him later for being used as his guinea pig and because she was dangerous. In the last half hour, Nathan started pacing the sick bay floor. Part of the reason for this was that he could not keep his mind wholly on his work. Nathan's thought lingered too often on the young lady attempting to reach the bridge with his friends despite the need to focus on the problem at hand. The continued hijacking of the ship meant Vin, Rain, and Ezra were so far unsuccessful in their attempt to penetrate the command center of the Maverick. Were they all right? Worse yet, were they harmed? Did that mean Rain too? Even though they met only hours ago, Nathan was wise enough to admit he cared for her. Rain was unlike any person he ever met. Symbiote notwithstanding. Aside from being completely fearless, her previous hosts allowed her to view the world with a unique perception. Somehow, she could see past the reservations that kept people from appreciating what was truly important in life. Nathan was an unashamed workaholic, yet Rain penetrated the stolid boundaries of his existence to make him look forward to more than just his work. The very idea of anything happening to Rain so soon after Nathan found her was unacceptable. Josiah saw through his fears easily. The counselor noted the anxiety creeping into the healer's manner in the last hour. It did not take an extreme leap of deduction to know what preyed so heavily on Nathan's mind. Rain affected the usually reserved chief medical officer, and Josiah understood he was bearing witness to the start of something special.
"I'm sure she's fine,"
Josiah assured him inside the force field, reinitialized after Vin and Rain left sick bay. The counselor occupied his mind for the last 10 minutes by watching the dancing waves of energy moving through the air before him, swirling in place to keep them from harm. If one could look past the fact it was merely a force field, it was quite beautiful.
"They should have been there by now,"
Nathan stated as he looked up from his workstation.
"Perhaps,"
Josiah agreed, but not about to entertain notions of defeat just yet.
"However, we can't assume the worst. They might have encountered an unforeseen problem. That isn't beyond the realm of possibility."
Nathan was aware of that, which was why he was so worried.
"I hope it's something they can handle since we're doing very little here to help them."
He stood up abruptly, glaring at his terminal.
"It's infuriating."
"Give it time."
Josiah took Nathan's ire in good stead.
"Time is something we don't have a lot of. Their minds are infected with this second energy signature, and I have no idea how to remove it. I've run simulations using the medical database, bombarded the cerebral cortex with every form of treatment to dispel that second brain wave pattern. I've even considered some unorthodox methods that would get me banned from the medical community if I actually attempted it, and still, I can't be sure if it would work. How these entities attach themselves to their host's neural pathways is beyond me."
"Nathan, take a moment to let your thoughts settle. You're too close to the issue."
"We can't afford to do that. You heard Vin. We're moving at warp, which means they're going somewhere with the Maverick. We don't know how far off course that could take us, not to mention what these aliens intend to do when they arrive."
Josiah could not deny things appeared grim at present, but the fears Nathan had for Rain's safety clouded his judgment and contributed to Nathan's frustration.
"Brother Nathan,"
the counselor folded his arms and gave Nathan a thoughtful look.
"I'm going to give you a professional evaluation of your present state of mind. Care to hear it?"
Nathan straightened up and suspected he would not but didn't wish to deny Josiah the opportunity to speak. Besides, he was panicking and needed to snap out of it, or he would be no good to anyone. An objective view of his behavior might be what he required to sharpen his focus.
"Go ahead."
"I think you need to calm yourself. You care about Rain, and that's a big step for you. It's one I hope you will explore in the future. But like every man and woman in the service, you know the risk is part of the job. We gamble with our lives when we come out here, and if you choose to pursue a relationship with Rain, you must accept you could lose her."
The healer exhaled deeply and realized Josiah was right.
Oh.
He suddenly wondered how Sarah Larrabee endured her marriage to Chris. As a commanding officer, Chris was at the highest risk of all the shipboard complement. Command officers went on away missions. They stood in the line of fire when the ship went into battle. and they were the face upon which the enemy focused their rage. It was ironic Chris outlived his wife when all probabilities indicated he would have been the one to die first. It must have been unbelievable to the captain for Sarah to die in a freak shuttle accident for all the danger Chris faced regularly.
You're right. I've never been on the other end of a relationship like this before. I've always faced the risk, not the other way around.
Turning tables is how we see someone else's perspective.
I can't say that you're wrong, Josiah,
Nathan admitted. A small smile crooked the corner of the healer's lip, and he gave Josiah a warm look of thanks before turning back to his workstation. It was time to put this aside and work on their immediate problem, Nathan decided and sat down at his desk.
Maybe I'm coming at this the wrong way.
How so?
Josiah asked, knowing when it was necessary to give someone a mental prodding when they needed it. If there was a way to find a solution to their present crisis through medical means, there was no one else on board who could accomplish this feat better than Nathan Jackson.
I've been treating this thing like it's a disease, and that hasn't worked. I've tried every medical way of ejecting the life force from our people, and it failed. If I use more extreme methods, I can't guarantee I won't be harming the patient.
But it's not a disease,
Josiah pointed out.
It's a life form, and if it has a purpose, it will not leave until it gets what it wants.
A life form?
Nathan mused for a moment, and Josiah saw his eyes suddenly narrow with calculation as if he had just latched onto a spark of something big with the potential to be more. When he raised his eyes to meet Josiah's again, the counselor saw a serious expression on the healer's face.
You're right, we're dealing with a life form, a sentient being.
Shall we assume it is a life form with fully developed mental and emotional responses?
Josiah asked, seeing Nathan's mind at work.
Yes,
Nathan nodded, running over in his mind everything that had taken place during the last day. In seconds, the mosaic inside his head was forming something tangible with which he could work with.
They've immobilized the ship using subterfuge, lies, and strategy. This isn't the behavior of a life form acting on instinct, is it?
It was a rhetorical question, but Josiah answered.
No, it isn't. They've displayed the actions of an intelligent, sentient life form.
Exactly, so if we can't treat this thing like a disease, we have to think about this as a life form. Thinking this is like a virus could very well kill the patient by our attempts to remove it. We have to attack this from another avenue.
Josiah took a deep breath and considered Nathan's words.
If we were talking about territory or space occupied by an invader, we would engage in negotiation and diplomatic channels to secure their release. Obviously, we can't do that here.
No,
the doctor shook his head and began pacing once again. Only this time it was not because he was nervous about Rain, but because an idea was forming inside his head.
They've been locked up for almost 500,000 years. Whatever they're doing now, they've had a long time to plan it. Think about it, trapped inside that artifact, hurtling through space for thousands of years. What does that do to a normal, intelligent mind?
The answer shouted so loudly in Josiah's head, he up abruptly from the bio bed he'd been sitting on.
That's it, Nathan, that's it.
What?
Nathan looked at him, uncertain of what he had said.
Fear.
The counselor cried out exuberantly.
What is the one thing you would be afraid of most after being imprisoned? Dying? Of course not. Death is a release, not a threat after that kind of incarceration. For the first time in so long, they're free to do more than just drift like space flotsam. You say we need to appeal to them to get them to release Mary and the others? I say we scare them into leaving.
Scare them into leaving? If they're not afraid of dying, what else is there?
That's easy,
Josiah said with a smug smile, more than prepared for that seemingly impossible question.
Being trapped again.
That's good.
Nathan smiled, admiring Josiah's logic but not the practical application.
But how do we scare them into believing that?
I'm not sure,
Josiah answered. His genius did not have the limits to hurdle that obstacle yet. His shoulders sagged with disappointment, having hoped that one idea would give way to another. Unfortunately, he had gone as far as he could with this notion. Nathan stood over Charlotte Richmond's body and stared into the unconscious woman's face. She was somewhere inside her own mind, unable to do anything while some creature had free use of her body. Not that her body was much use to the alien in its present state while strapped to an examination table and so filled with drugs it could do nothing but lie there helplessly. Lie there helplessly. Drifting through space helplessly. The situation was the same. Only the prison had changed. Instead of a crystal artifact, the entity inside Charlotte was now trapped in a jail of flesh and blood. The power produced by that one piece of reasoning filled his mind with staggering potential, and suddenly, without even questioning the stray beads of random thought, Nathan knew what they had to do.
"You're right, Josiah,"
the healer spoke in a hushed voice, almost as if he dared not believe they had found their answer and that speaking it out loud might jinx it somehow.
"They aren't afraid of dying, but they are afraid of being trapped again, and we're going to do just that."
"We are?"
Josiah asked, unable to guess what Nathan had in mind by that enigmatic look on his face.
"How?"
"By trapping them in the bodies they've stolen."
Chris Larrabee felt numb. When Salya calmly announced the decompression of the cargo hold, an overpowering sense of deja vu overwhelmed him. He remembered when he was told about Sarah and Adam. He sat in the office of Captain Patterson, staring blankly at the man, unable to feel anything but this deep sense of loss that would soon break out of the confines of disbelief to send him spiraling into the blackest hole he had ever fallen into. Through the abyss of darkness in the months after that tragic event, Chris remained in a constant state of detachment until Buck pulled him back from the path of self-destruction. Losing people was a part of the job. While grieving for a wife and child was expected, the death of three crewmates should not have hit him as hard as it did. How many had been lost during the last battle with the Dominion? While Chris knew the exact number, all their deaths did not make him feel as terrible as knowing Vin, Ezra, and even Transporter Chief Rain were dead. Vin and Ezra were his friends. They were a part of the Magnificent Seven who rode together in that holodeck program, and the bond was more than just some simulated game but one that existed in reality. Chris remained where he was, still shell-shocked, swearing inwardly he would end this because he was losing no one else to these invaders. Neither would he sit here on the floor of his own bridge, wondering why this was happening when the answers waited for the asking. "Where are we going?" Chris rose to his feet and demanded, caring for none of the consequences. Beside him, Buck and JD had been equally silent. Like him, they reeled from the loss of Vin and Ezra.
"You are not in a position to ask questions."
Nerida paused long enough in her vigil to snap sharply. Even though she raised her gun to fire, Chris did not back down, ignoring the fact she looked like Mary because it was not Mary standing before him, but the creature who stole her body.
"Then go ahead. I know you disabled the self-destruct program, so you don't have any use for me, but right now, I don't give a damn about any of that. Tell me what the hell is going on, or else pull the trigger and stop wasting my time, little girl."
Nerida glanced over her shoulder at Exhala, waiting for her leader to give her permission to fire. Since the death of the three officers who attempted to beam onto the bridge, the captain had become unmanageable and increasingly difficult to control. Nerida preferred to end him once and for all. She waited in anticipation of the order when suddenly, Exhala rose slowly from the command chair. The creature wearing Casey Wells' body like a suit of clothes closed the distance between them in seconds. Exhala placed her hand on Nerida's to lower the weapon.
"We owe them nothing. They would not do the same for us."
"That is true."
Exhala nodded, her voice still cold.
"But we always claimed we were better than his kind, so we will prove it."
She faced Chris and let out a sigh. Chris saw something in the young woman's face that could be resignation and perhaps even a little weariness.
"You have questions, Captain. Ask them."
Chris glanced at Buck, puzzled by this sudden acquiescence and more than a little suspicious that this was a trick. However, since Chris could do little about it and had forced the issue, he decided to give them the benefit of the doubt. "Who are you?"
"You know our names,"
Exhala answered coolly with Nerida's frown, deepening with intense hatred, standing guard behind her. The woman kept her gun poised to fire and showed her distaste at the present course of events.
"What race are you?"
he demanded again, realizing she would not make it easy for him.
"Our race was called the Akra, but our kind is Undaya,"
she responded after a second of hesitation. Behind her, Nerida grimaced at the word.
"You mean that was what females are called in your language?"
Buck ventured a guess, his voice still raspy.
"No, that was the name they referred to us in our society. We are Undaya, and those of your kind are Daya."
"I don't understand."
Chris wrinkled a brow in confusion, wondering if it was just him that could not grasp the concept or was she explaining it poorly. Undaya is not the name of your gender, but a classification given to all women?
Ex-Holler, if you would allow me.
Alex rose from helm control and joined in the conversation. Ex-Holler gave a nod of approval to continue, and the Alex entity bowed her head in graciousness. With Alexandra Styles' memories and because of her position as science officer, the creature inhabiting her body could understand this culture much better than the others.
You call yourselves males and us females. Is that correct?
Yes, Chris nodded, hoping she could shed some light on what Ex-Holler had tried to say.
In Accra, it was the same, but besides that classification, we were also Undaya.
What does that mean?
JD asked Ex-Holler, forgetting she was not Casey even though she was, in every respect, the girl he loved.
In our language, Undaya means weaker. We were called the weaker.
Narita snorted, her voice unbidden in the bitterness she felt as she gave that translation, and suddenly Chris suspected these aliens might have excellent reason to hate anything male.
God,
Buck whispered, not about to hide the disgust at that statement. He hated the thinking that would brand one group as inferior simply because of what they were. Inwardly, the attitude of such bigotry towards the fairer sex always infuriated him. His own mother raised him alone, with little education and not in the best of circumstances, but she managed because she was strong and she loved him. Anyone who claimed a woman was weak had just never met one who was strong and did not know any better. Ex-Hala's brow shot upwards as Buck made that depreciating remark. His reaction mildly surprised her, and she continued speaking after a moment.
In our culture, the Undaya have no rights. From the moment we were born, our place is secondary to Daya. We had no say in our society, no permission to read or write. Daya could demand anything of us, and we could not refuse. We lived, and we died, without the right to choose.
Jesus Christ, that is cruel.
You think so?
Ex-Holler laughed.
You cannot conceive the extent of what is cruel. We lived as slaves to whatever man claimed us as his mate. Not wife as your kind know it, but mate. He may choose as many as he likes and discard us if he requires us no more. Discarded wives often considered themselves fortunate if allowed to remain in the home since Undaya cannot work. It is a shame to be born Undaya, and the only reason they did not eradicate us completely is that we were necessary to bear new Daya.
Chris did not know what to say because Earth culture had similar chapters of such ugliness in its history books. Until the 21st century, many women were still regarded as property and were most often the victims of wars. Since its inception, Christianity preached women were to be treated as second-class citizens, casting them as greater instigators of mischief than any other force in the Bible. Not that it was the only offender. Most Arabic religions cast women in the same light, robbing them of the most basic freedoms while conducting brutal punishments if they did not obey. As much as Chris was disgusted by the behavior of the Akrans, he could not scream with outrage when his own race was guilty of such cruelty.
How did you end up in space?
Chris finally asked, since that was the safest question.
Despite its barbarism, our culture was technologically advanced.
The Alex alien answered.
We achieved interstellar travel not different from your warp field method of propulsion. The deer left our world and explored space, discovering many other races, and soon outside influences opened the eyes of the Undaya to what they always believed in their hearts to be the truth, that they were just as capable as any deer. We saw we were not alone, and there were worlds beyond ours where things were different.
And for that, they put you in space.
JD exclaimed, shocked at the existence of such a short-sighted race. He grew up in a society of equals and could not fathom a culture with such restrictive parameters for its female members. Besides the physiological differences, a woman could perform any duty the same as a man. His mother certainly proved that much, anyway. It was by her JD judged every woman he met, and those were lofty standards indeed.
No.
Ex-Holler shook her head, and the men in the room noticed a somber expression on their faces as if a dark secret seldom spoken of was about to be revealed.
There came a time when something began happening to us. It mostly arrived at the onset of puberty. At first, we did not know what it was. The authorities believed it to be a mutation of some sort, which was all the excuse they needed to imprison us. They quarantined those displaying the symptoms and subjected us to sterilization.
Oh my God.
Buck gasped at the atrocity.
What exactly was this thing that happened to you?
We are uncertain, and, in retrospect, it matters little.
The alien inhabiting Alex sighed.
However, to satisfy your curiosity, I will try to elaborate. We were undergoing a physiological change. Heightened awareness, extrasensory powers, some of us could start fires, others had the power to move objects, and those in extreme stages of the condition could alter their physical matter into pure energy. Those who did often left us and went into the stars. Those of us who remained escaped the camps. X-Holler was our leader. Narita here is our infiltrator. Salia was our thinker and strategist, and I was the information gatherer. We liberated other camps and prevented as many forced sterilizations as we could.
You were resistance fighters, Chris stated.
Yes, we were resistance fighters.
X-Holler said the words with a smile, liking how that sounded.
The Daya believed if they sterilize us, it would contain the situation. It was only the Undaya who changed. There was no Daya who developed the symptoms. They were so accustomed to being stronger, the idea we may usurp them and make them Undaya themselves was so terrifying they were willing to commit any atrocity to prevent it.
Chris, it was not a mutation, but the next phase in their evolutionary growth. Think of it this way, the only freedom the Undaya had was their minds. They developed their minds because the Daya restricted them from everything else. Their mental abilities escalated because they no longer needed their physical ones.
Do you mean to say what happened to us was natural?
Salia muttered with more than a hint of astonishment.
That it was part of our genetic evolution.
We have encountered other races with this kind of evolutionary pattern. Ours, for instance, took place in the same fashion. Chris was still mindful that these people killed Vin and Ezra, but he could understand their rage and violence after what he had just heard. We descended from simian ancestors during long periods of constancy and short bursts of change, where we would evolve. It's called punctuated gradualism.
It doesn't matter what it's called.
Narita erupted angrily, outraged they were indulging these Daya. Did the others remember nothing of those terrible days before their exile into a living death?
Shall I tell you what they did to us, human? Shall I tell you in the hard, unblemished truth?
Narita.
X-Holler barked sharply.
Be still.
No.
Narita shouted back defiantly.
They want to know? Let us tell them.
She turned back to Chris and glared at him with nothing less than hate.
After the Daya took away that which allowed us to give life to the future, they gathered together 500 Undaya and gave us an ultimatum. Our sisters would be executed if we did not surrender.
I'm sorry. Chris said softly, feeling genuine empathy for these creatures and the hardship they endured. However, his anger at the death of his friends did not allow Chris to be as sympathetic as he liked.
Your platitudes are worthless to us. They are just words, no different from those used by the Daya to whom we surrendered ourselves, who killed the 500 anyway. They sped up the mutation process with us in their custody, destroying our bodies by converting its matter into energy and then encasing us in that crystal tomb. They ejected us into space like we were nothing and allowed us to drift for 500,000 years. Do you even have the slightest conception of what that is like? Do you?
Narita.
X-Holler spoke more firmly this time.
You have spoken enough. You will remain silent and do what is required.
Narita glared at them with smoldering eyes and then raised her gun in a position of attack, warning them she would permit no other allowance after this. She would take great pleasure in shooting everyone on the bridge if they gave her a reason. Chris would not be calling her bluff. He had his answers. Now it was time to consider their options at what they would do with this information. After X-Holler had sent Alex and Salia back to their posts, she faced Chris again.
So now you know what we really are. We mean to go home, Captain. If they are still there, the Daya will pay. We will take this ship and reduce their descendants to radioactive ash, and then we will go home to start again.
What about my female crew members? Chris demanded, aware they could do nothing without the bodies they had stolen, and that observation led him to a conclusion, not at all palatable.
We need their bodies to fight our war,
X-Holler stated automatically.
You have no right to steal their lives,
JD shouted angrily, infuriated by the idea X-Holler would not relinquish Casey's body even when they arrived at their destination.
The women of this vessel are soldiers, Captain,
X-Holler said as she turned away and returned to the command chair.
And in all wars, there are casualties. They will die for a just cause.
Chapter 13. Homecoming. Assistant Chief Engineer Chanu was not happy, but he was even more confused. For the last few hours, all the males of the engineering staff, himself included, were held hostage within the confines of the engineering deck by its female members. Things had been strange ever since Julia Pemberton authorized the deactivation of all internal communications on board the Maverick. While he accepted the need for a complete diagnostic after the recent hostilities with the Dominion, he disagreed with her decision to shut down the turbolifts. His challenge to her authority led to the extraordinary situation where every male became a hostage at gunpoint. Chanu couldn't even remember when they had raided the armory, but supposed they must have if he was staring at the business end of a phaser held by Junior Lieutenants Bean and Mosley. At first, he had thought this was a joke because these were people he worked with daily. On a starship, bonds turned into deep friendships. Being the only creatures in a ship so far from home created a sense of community among those who inhabited the Maverick. Thus, Chanu didn't put up a fight until it was too late. However, he soon discovered he was in a deadly situation when he saw the women, having taken control of engineering, make their move towards the bridge. When the throbbing hum of the warp core increased, he knew the ship was pushing warp 9 to reach a destination he was sure was not the resort world of Pacifica. The jump to warp 9 signaled the taking of the bridge. Now Chanu, who had more than enough ability to stop this odd insurrection from continuing further, found himself helpless by the law of the gun, running supreme in engineering. Lieutenant Mosley observed him while armed with a phaser rifle, suspecting he would be the source of any resistance from the group. Chanu wrestled with the possibility she might actually shoot him. Claire Mosley was a pretty thing with blonde hair and delicate features, and not more than once, Chanu secretly admired her silky gold hair and the sweet smile that crossed her face when happy.
Claire, what's happened to you?
Quiet.
Chanu flinched at the harshness of it. Usually, Claire's voice was soft and melodic. It moved across the skin like satin, and he never heard her say an angry word to anyone, not even when she was upset. Perhaps it was because she had such a sweet temperament that made Chanu so affronted by her present behavior. Still, instinct told him this was not Claire. Something was occupying her body.
Claire.
Chanu tried again, not to be deterred.
I know this isn't you, but you must fight this. What you're doing is wrong.
Shoot him.
Lieutenant Bean snapped.
No, we were told not to harm anyone.
He is troublesome.
He should be. He's the assistant chief engineer.
Claire issued a silent plea for him to remain silent. Chanu caught the warning and didn't know if Claire was so concerned about him, or the thing inhabiting her body. In either case, it was advice well worth taking. Chanu shared a sigh of resignation with another of his fellow engineers and decided, for the time being, he would have to tolerate this incarceration. Although they were being held at bay by only Claire and Lieutenant Bean, the phase rifles provided ample reason for caution. Besides, Chanu couldn't tell if they set the rifles for stun or kill, and he wasn't about to learn the hard way by doing anything stupid. Besides, a part of Chanu was uncertain of what to do, even if they could rush the duo. How much force should they use against Claire and the lieutenant? Despite their hostile intent, Chanu did not know enough about what was happening to the women on board to risk hurting them. He would have to wait until he knew more, and Chanu hated waiting. As he sat on the engineering floor, seething with frustration, he couldn't deny it was his feelings for Claire fueling his hesitation. However, at some point, Chanu would have to set aside his emotions for his duty to the Maverick.
It should not be much longer.
Sophia Bean told Claire after a few more minutes crawled past.
We will soon be home.
If there is anything left of home.
Claire responded, sadness creeping into her eyes.
Do not think that way. We can finally deliver to the day our revenge.
Do you honestly think they even exist anymore?
Claire returned skeptically.
They exist.
Sophia eyed her sharply, hating that they would be robbed of revenge after all their suffering. Being denied of retribution was unthinkable.
I see them no other way.
The debate between the two women became lost in the background when something else captured his attention. Recovering quickly, Chanu hid his surprise at his new development, watching through the corner of his eye the slim barrel of something metallic inching past the corner of the warp core reactor room. No one but himself saw it, and as Chanu feigned compliance to their captors, he continued to watch until it became visible enough for Chanu to identify it. A tranquilizer gun. Chanu couldn't understand why one was needed since a phaser rifle could do the same job until he remembered it was a noisier weapon.
Stealth was required to take both women before they could harm their hostages. The weapon pivoted toward Claire, still unseen, and for a second, Chanu felt inclined to warn her until he remembered this wasn't Claire standing before him and his people with a gun. It was a stranger.
Oh.
Claire reacted instantly when the tiny dart struck the base of her neck after the gun discharged with a soft hiss. Sophia reacted immediately. When Claire uttered the cry, she jumped to her feet, searching for danger. As the barrel fired again, sending a small projectile towards her, she tried to fire the phase rifle. However, the tiny dart struck her skin in mid-torso. She reached for it, not realizing it was already too late. The dart's payload had already emptied into her body. Sophia heard the clatter of something against the floor. It was Claire's gun, slipping past the blonde woman's fingers to hit the deck below her.
What is wrong?
Sophia demanded until a sudden warmth enveloped her limbs. An intense feeling of vertigo soon accompanied this sensation as she realized what was happening to her.
Drugged.
Claire mouthed just before she dropped to her knees. Chanya saw the opening and wasted no time. Before both women slipped into unconsciousness, he and his fellow engineers leapt into action. They grabbed the phasers abandoned on the floor and swept them up into their own hands in fluid, graceful movements. In seconds, the former hostages were once again in control of the engineering deck.
Is everyone all right?
Josiah Sanchez asked as he stepped out from behind the shadows. Thanks to the Magnificent Seven holodeck program, he could aim at his targets with a fair amount of accuracy.
We're fine,
Chanu assured him gratefully.
Good shooting, counselor.
Did it work?
Nathan Jackson stepped into the room behind the psychiatrist and saw the two women lying on the floor. Without saying another word, he hurried to their side to make a quick examination.
Are they going to be all right?
Chanu joined Nathan, concerned for Claire still foremost in his mind now the danger had passed.
They're out cold,
Nathan stated, grateful the sedative he selected to subdue the two women worked so effectively. Their pulse was steady as he examined their vitals and knew each woman would remain unconscious for the next 10 hours.
But they'll wake up in a few hours with no side effects. Hopefully, by then, we'll get this situation under control.
With all that out of the way, Chanu took the next logical step.
Now we've got that cleared up. Can you please tell me what the hell is going on?
What is going on is that we are under attack. An alien influence has taken over almost every woman on this ship. I'm assuming the order to disrupt communications and disable turbo lifts and transporters came from here?
Yes.
Chanu nodded, still reeling from the extent of the problem. He hoped their situation was isolated but supposed it was always an unrealistic expectation.
Chief Engineer Pemberton said we needed to run a diagnostic. I didn't question it until she ordered the turbo lifts and transporters shut down.
Look, how things got shut down isn't important.
Josiah spoke up, sensing the engineer was feeling a little defensive.
We have a plan to retake the ship.
Chanu turned to Nathan in surprise, not expecting such a statement to come from the CMO or the counselor, but was not about to argue the point. Both men were senior staff officers, which meant he was at their disposal.
What do you have in mind?
Vin did not know how he knew. In space, there was no sound. There was no medium in which it could travel, but when he felt the tingle of steel underfoot as they made their way to the bridge, he could feel it coming. It reverberated through the thick hull of the ship, found release on the floor, and continued its journey through his bones before dissipating entirely. Ezra and Rain did not notice it, but this hardly surprised Vin. They were not pilots. Vin was a born flyer. In his mind, he was an aviator like those who flew airplanes at the turn of the 20th century. Of course, what he piloted compared to those flying machines made of wood and canvas was the difference between a horse-drawn cart and the space shuttle. Still, the essence of it was the same. It took a specific type to feel in perfect control of the skies. Since piloting his first shuttle, Vin had been on intimate terms with every ship he ever flew. Only Julia Pemberton could understand what he meant. The sounds made by the Maverick were his secret language to master. Vin could tell when she had a damaged relay, recognize the slight shimmy whenever they flew through intense gravimetric eddies, and he knew when the ship was about to drop out of warp.
Grappling hooks now!
Ezra and Arane obeyed immediately. Both were trained professionals who knew an order issued with this amount of vehemence was not to be questioned. Aiming their gauntlets at the ship's hull, they deployed their grappling hooks again. The magnetic grappling hooks did not have a short distance to go, striking the metal in less than a second, causing a slight shudder through the floor on impact. Vin had already followed suit and was bracing himself.
Hold on, we're about to come out of warp.
And the fun keeps coming.
I think I should have remained in bed today.
Ezra remarked with just as much ire. If not properly secured when the ship dropped out of warp, they would fly off the hull at such speeds the flesh would tear away from their bones, even with an environmental suit. A few more seconds passed before the star speeding past them during the long trek to the bridge came to an abrupt halt. Space contracted around them, and, for a brief instant, one might believe they were indeed the center of the universe as those stars paused to surround them. The sudden stop did exactly what Vin thought it would. The momentum threw them forward until the slack in the tether line was reached, and the tension snapped them back against the hull once again. Vin felt his stomach lunge into his throat when he landed on the duranium surface. His hands braced his landing and kept Vin's helmet from cracking open if his faceplate impacted against the hull. Through the comms inside the helmet, salty language reached his ears from the others, and Vin could appreciate how they felt. For a few seconds, he didn't move, needing a little time to recover from this latest perilous situation. The whole trip to the bridge had been one roller coaster ride after another.
I trust we are all in one piece.
From where he stood, Ezra searched the hull of the Maverick to see Vin and Rain straightening up after their latest adventure on the hull. It reminded him of an insect caught against the plexiglass of a hovercart. Ezra shook away the image because the association was too close to home now.
More or less.
You boys always have this much fun?
Rain pushed herself upright and dusted herself off. She did not know why she was doing this since there was no dust but supposed the reaction mainly was reflex.
This is nothing.
Vin chuckled slightly, liking the dry humor of the transporter chief.
You should see it when we really get into trouble.
If you could suspend your charming repertoire, you might observe where we are.
The security chief gestured to the space before them. What should have been the breathtaking sight of a planet with one moon, luminescent with the life of a living world radiating against a field of stars, was nowhere in sight. What lay before them was none of these things, neither alive nor beautiful. There was only one word to describe it, and it pained them all to say it. Armageddon. The planet itself was dark and charred, as evidenced by the destruction temporarily illuminated by stars as it continued its revolution around the sun. The weapon capable of creating this obscene waste was unknown, but it left great rips in the surface and large craters of black covering much of the planet. A ring of debris circled the world, formed artificially in the wake of what was sure to be the destruction of another stellar body. This caused the planet to be routinely subject to asteroid bombardment.
My God, what happened here?
Without sensors.
Ezra shook his head in horror.
It's hard to say.
Nothing could live there.
I think they did.
Vin indicated the aliens who stole the Maverick and the bodies of all the female crew members.
Not much of a homecoming.
It has been 500,000 years.
Ezra pointed out.
One must expect some changes.
Some changes, yes.
Vin could not imagine what could have precipitated such complete destruction of a world. What justification had there been in this terrible sight before them?
Not this.
In either case, we need to get to the captain. After witnessing this spectacular sight, our guests are not likely to be very charitable.
Ezra's tone reminded them that the ship was still in danger, and their friends waited for liberation on the bridge.
There should be a maintenance hatch on the bulkhead directly above the captain's ready room. We can get in through there and continue towards maintenance shaft 32A, which will bring us into the ventilation system.
Oh, the scenic route.
Rain joked.
It will take us into the ready room and not the bridge.
Ezra said shortly, not in the mood for jokes. Not with the day he was having.
We will have some measure of surprise.
Assuming no one is in the ready room.
That is what I love about you, Mr. Tanner. You are always such an optimistic soul.
Unfortunately, optimistic or not, Ezra knew it was the only way they could reach the captain. The bridge was silent. No one spoke because the view screen captured all their attention. Horror, shock, and sadness briefly unified the enemy and their hostages. The planet and its moon lingered on the screen, a stark reminder of how much destruction, violence, and hatred could produce when left to rage unchecked. As Chris saw the pained expression on the faces of the enemy, he could not help but feel some pity for them at the sorrow they felt at this moment. Chris had been a lieutenant commander on the Alexander when the Borg first ventured into the Alpha Quadrant and made its bid to take Earth. They had sent every available ship to hold the line at Wolf 359 against one Borg cube. The Alexander had not arrived in time to join the battle, but what they found when they did was the remains of 20 starships, totally destroyed. It was the single most demoralizing defeat the Federation had suffered since its war with the Romulans 200 years ago. Seeing all those ships, broken, floating in space in a field of debris, imprinted itself on the minds of everyone who saw it and marked him forever. Watching the faces of the aliens who had stolen the bodies of his crewmen, not to mention his ship, Chris could imagine what they felt now was not too different from what he had experienced at Wolf 359.
"That cannot be a craw,"
Salia gasped softly. Anguish reflected her eyes.
"It is,"
the Alexanity confirmed somberly.
"We are home."
"They destroyed it,"
Narada exclaimed.
"The Daya destroyed a craw."
"What do the scans say?"
Exhala asked quietly, her voice nothing but a hoarse whisper. Salia looked at the readings on the console, hoping to find some evidence of life, but Chris knew she had not when she looked up. The sensors confirmed what they saw with their eyes. The world was as dead as it appeared.
"Some form of antimatter weapon. I am uncertain of what type exactly. Judging by the metallurgical scans of the debris, they used it on one of the twin moons."
"My god,"
Buck gasped, wondering who was foolish enough to wreak this kind of destruction.
"That would have caused a planetary catastrophe. Aside from the debris, the shock wave might have been enough to knock the planet a degree or two off its axis. They would have had global warming or an ice age in a second."
"Is this true?"
Exhala looked to the Alexanity, still manning the helm.
"Yes."
The Gatherer nodded sadly.
"That is exactly what would have happened."
"Confirmed,"
Salia responded from Alex's station.
"The planetary axis is irregular."
Exhala's shoulders slumped at the news, and Chris found his voice to speak. "I'm sorry." He genuinely meant it.
"Your kind did this,"
Narada swore, almost reduced to tears. Chris ignored her and regarded Exhala. "You've come home. I'm sorry it wasn't the homecoming you envisioned, but there is no more reason for this. Let us help you. The Federation can find you a new world to colonize. Your existence does not have to end. We know of many races who have attained higher levels of existence. They would welcome you. I am sure of it." Exhala met his gaze, her uncertainty apparent by the strained look in her eyes.
"Your kind are not known for your compassion."
"For the last time, we are not your kind."
Buck groaned in disbelief.
"Haven't you learned anything about us by now? We do not treat our women the way you were. Can't you see by how badly we want them back alive, we care about them?"
"Lies,"
Narada interrupted.
"Enough,"
Salia shouted and left her station to approach Exhala.
"We have nowhere to go, and if we steal these bodies and call our act a casualty of war, we become no better than Daya. Hala, we are free. For the first time in half of an eon, we are free. There are no more enemies to fight. The Daya have destroyed our world because of their hatred. Let us not continue this folly."
"They have corrupted you,"
Narada crossed the space between them to make her case.
"She coupled with one of them. Perhaps she has feelings for him."
Salia was about to speak when suddenly, Exhala glanced at the panel on the side of her command chair and noticed something that gave her immediate reason to halt the debate.
"Stop it, both of you. Someone is flooding all the decks with anesthesia gas."
"What?"
Salia exclaimed.
"That's impossible."
Chris and Buck were exchanging furious glances, using their kidnapper's distraction to form something of a plan because the time had come for them to reclaim the bridge. Obviously, someone had regained control of engineering. It was the only place capable of bypassing the bridge to carry out such a non-lethal attack.
"The order came from engineering,"
Salia shouted, mirroring Chris's thoughts on the matter.
"It's moving throughout the ship. All decks except engineering are being flooded."
Her voice was rife with anxiety.
"I am going to seal off the bridge."
As Chris waited for the opportunity to strike, Narada returned to her charges and glared at him.
"Well, Captain, I suppose you will have your wish. We are going to put an end to this. Just not in the way you imagined."
Chapter 14. Confrontation. Chris stared at the barrel of a phase rifle and wondered if this nightmare would ever end. He did not care so much about dying. Being captain made it an occupational hazard, but Chris minded departing this mortal existence without freeing Mary from her flesh and blood prison. That, He objected to a great deal, almost as much as he abhorred his last memory of his life would be her eyes, indifferent and dark, hastening his journey. The creature named Narada, who wore Mary's face, glared at him with unmasked hatred. After the story he heard, he supposed she was justified in feeling nothing but hate for anything male. The flooding of the Maverick with anesthetic gas produced an incendiary reaction among the aliens who still had control of the bridge. Still, Chris was glad someone on board was actively working towards freeing the ship from hostile control. If he survived this, he would pin a medal on the instigator of this plot. He only wished Buck and JD would not perish with him as he saw Narada gaze burn into his skin as she prepared to fire, naked in her relish, to commit murder.
You can make them discontinue this attack.
X-Hala rose from his command chair and strode towards him.
We will give you access to communicate with the ship. Tell those responsible to desist, or we will kill all of you.
Chris straightened up and looked at the creature wearing Casey's face. He glanced at Buck and JD briefly, who immediately guessed his response and nodded their approval. This siege couldn't continue. There came a time when enough was enough. Chris would not allow their lives to stand in the way of the safety of the entire crew of the Maverick. And that time was here. Then kill us, but I'm not doing anything to stop this.
Let me.
Narada sneered, almost pleasured by his refusal as she shoved the rifle barrel beneath his neck and engendered an immediate reaction from Buck and JD, who sprang to their feet to attack when X-Hala turned her weapon on them. Chris knew his old friend and the young ensign were just brave and stubborn enough to put up a fight if his life was in danger, no matter what the consequences to them personally.
Stand down, Buck. Chris ordered sharply, ignoring the cold feel of metal pressing against his skin.
He avoided Narada's eyes, aiming his stare as far as possible without turning his head towards the first officer and his young protege.
But Chris...
Buck opened his mouth to protest before Chris cut him off.
Do nothing, Commander. Chris turned back to X-Hala. Do you hear me, all of you? We will do nothing. If you want us to cooperate, then you will do it over our dead bodies, but you will not have any more control over my ship than you already do.
I will kill you all. I will have Narada incinerate you.
Then get on with it.
He drawled as if the threat was inconsequential, even though Narada was tightening her finger around the trigger to warn him how close he was to death. He kept his eyes away from the woman, not wishing the last thing he saw on this mortal plane to be Mary in this state.
No.
Salya shouted and left her station to approach X-Hala. For the last few seconds, she observed the proceedings while deciding what was to be done.
What is wrong with you?
Narada growled in her direction, accusation in her voice.
Are you so heated by the sensation of physical pleasure that you have lost all sense of who you are? These are the enemy. These are the ones who imprisoned us, who took our ability to give life and destroy it, who has given us cause for pain every day of our existence.
No, they're not.
Salya faced X-Hala, whose expression showed indecision for the first time. They were fast approaching an impasse even if they killed the captain.
That?
She gestured to the image of the ruined world still displayed on the view screen.
Is all that remains of our enemy and world.
X-Hala opened her mouth to deny that statement vehemently. But when the time came to form the words, none would come because Salya's claim was the truth. However, a roar filled her mind, the screaming of hundreds of voices in her head all at once. For a moment, the disorientation was so fierce she did not know what was happening but realized soon enough it was the many. They were screaming because they were imprisoned. The gas had flooded the rest of the ship, and she could feel the trapped minds of all the others swirling around in the limbo of unconsciousness as their host bodies fell prey to the noxious substance. The many were helpless now. They were almost as vulnerable as they had been when trapped inside the artifact and set adrift in space. Now their imprisonment was different, but the outcome was still the same. X-Hala felt their terror, desperation, and horror at returning to that terrible fate again, not after tasting freedom for so fleeting a time.
What have you done?
X-Hala grabbed Chris by the neck and almost screamed into his ear with tears of frustration running down her cheeks.
I feel them frightened and trapped. How did you do this?
He did nothing.
Salya spoke up quickly, her heart pounding as she saw the situation escalate beyond her ability to control it. Even the glacial one possessing Alexandra Styles' body was now wavering in her efforts to regain control of the ship and focusing more on the drama unfolding before her.
Shut up, you traitor.
Narada debated whether she ought to turn the gun in Salya's direction. For she who would turn against her own kind should deserve nothing less.
I am no traitor.
Salya sighed, looking wearier, battling with her own.
I am one of you, as I will always be, but we need to decide what that is exactly.
You speak in riddles. Her mind is addled. She can no longer be trusted.
Ex-Hala, you know me.
Salya ignored Narada's hysterics.
Do you remember when you and I first broke the chains keeping us prisoners? We began the rebellion. We convinced the others to join us.
Ex-Hala nodded slowly.
I remember, Salya. Those were hard times, but also good ones.
Chris remained silent because it looked like Salya might bring about a peaceful resolution to this situation. As much as he wanted to make them pay for Vin, Ezra, and Transporter Chief Rain, he had to rise beyond his need for vengeance. He had to be captain, not friend, and though it pained him deeply to put aside his rage, he could do nothing else because he was captain and the Maverick was his crew. If Chris was after a peaceful resolution to this situation, the unexpected opening of his ready room doors ended that hope. Chris didn't know who fired first, but the weapon pressed against his throat left his neck abruptly as Narada swung around to deal with this new threat. Chris dove out of the way as she fired, as did Buck and JD for a moment. Chris was uncertain of what was happening until he saw Vin, Ezra, and Rain fan out across the bridge. Relief washed over him seeing they were alive and well, wondering briefly how they survived before deciding to hell with it. They were okay, and it was time to act. Most of the phaser blasts were coming from Narada, and Chris found himself in a position of decided advantage since she was shooting with her back to him. He saw Buck and JD waiting for their opportunity to join the attack, but he was closer and rolled onto his knees, preparing to lunge at her. He never got the chance. A foot slammed into his ribs, almost flipping him over. Chris felt bones break in an instant as he landed on his back to look into the face of Ex-Hala standing over him. Guessing he intended to attack Narada, she intercepted him spectacularly. The pain was almost blinding, and Chris saw he was not only bleeding, but the bloody protrusion quickly soaking his uniform was bone. He groaned until he saw Ex-Hala reaching down to drag him to his feet, a phaser in her hand. He was not about to become her hostage, and though it pained him greatly to do so, Chris kicked out and sent the ball of his heel into her sternum. She let out a cry of pain and went sprawling as he rolled onto his knees again and started crawling. Buck was on his feet, trying to reach him when Alex brought Buck down like a linebacker. Both of them rolled across the floor as the bridge was a zigzag of phaser blasts, with even Salya firing at the new arrivals, not swayed enough in her attempt to stop the fighting by taking sides against her own. She took cover behind the command chair thanks to Ezra's near-perfect aim. Even if the enemy wore Julia's face, the security chief was not about to be swayed from freeing the bridge. The southerner's expression was a stone mask as he continued shooting while Vin tried to get past the stray blasts of phaser energy to help Buck, who was wrestling with Alex for the second time today. Buck's throat was still aching from where she had hit him earlier, so he was not about to let down his guard or be deluded enough into believing she would not hurt him because she would. Holding nothing back, the first officer threw his fist into her face and sent her tumbling off him, but she recovered quickly, accustomed to taking blows in her brutal holodeck combat programs. While still on her knees, she kicked out her foot and toppled him off his feet. Buck dropped onto his knees and saw her spring to her feet. Her agility was almost feline as she prepared to kick out again. He avoided her boot from crushing his windpipe, convinced she would undoubtedly kill him if she connected with the tender flesh. Buck grabbed her foot and twisted it hard, forcing her to spin in midair to land heavily on her chest. He scrambled forward to pin her down to the floor with his weight when her fist flew upwards just as he crossed the space above her head. The punch was strong and connected with his ribs. If he had been a little slower, Buck knew it would have cracked his sternum. Unfortunately, the respite was fleeting because the action had been to buy her time. She rolled onto her back and flipped upright. This time, she and Buck faced each other, knowing that one of them would not walk away from this. She threw her fist at him, and Buck caught it, marveling at her speed and wondering what on earth Alex was doing, wasting her time with a science posting when she was so effective in combat. He dodged the blow and caught her retreating arm between his before yanking her forward, using masculine strength and skill before flipping her over.
Alex, don't make me hurt you.
Buck pleaded as she landed hard and heard a cry of pain. She did not answer but got to her feet again. Throwing a front kick he barely avoided and had to retreat backward to keep from being hit. She quickly threw them until he was backpedaling to avoid her. Buck was fending her off, but the glint in her eye clearly showed she was out to kill him. He had to stop pulling his punches, or she would succeed.
Screw this.
He caught her leg again, twisting it hard, so she lost her balance. Before she could regain it, Buck swung, hard and controlled. The blow caught her in the jaw and made her stagger back. She shook it off, but Buck didn't intend to let her recover. He swung again, slamming his fist into the side of her head, and this time, her recovery was not as rapid, and she slowed down, trying to clear away the disorientation. Buck punched again, and once more, his knuckles connected with flesh. Blood ran down her nose and her lip. He fought his revulsion because he could think of nothing more disgusting than to hit a woman, especially one he made passionate love to only a few hours ago. But it was not Alex then, and it was not Alex now. The woman was reeling with blood staining her face, but she remained standing with the determination that was Alex in some small way. It was clear she could not take much of this beating. He could see she was nearly done, but sheer stubbornness refused to let her surrender. Buck took the choice out of her hands. He pulled her to him by the shoulders in one last move and slammed his forehead against hers. She crumpled to the floor unconscious, and Buck let out a sigh of relief because he couldn't have tolerated much more of this bloody brawl. Meanwhile, Ezra concentrated on draining Narita of every ounce of energy in her phaser until he noticed Casey Wells or the entity occupying her body, attempting to take the captain hostage despite Chris's best efforts to evade her. Ezra could see the extent of the captain's injury as he fought off the young woman trying to hit him with a stun blast from where he was. So far, he avoided a crippling shot. But Chris was in pain and could not last any longer. Unfortunately, Ezra couldn't reach Chris to help him since the creatures using Julia and Mary made it impossible for him to cross the distance.
Lieutenant Rain!
Ezra shouted at Rain, crouched behind the science station.
I'm a little busy right now.
She squeezed off another shot at Narita, who was taking cover behind the command chair.
I would not have guessed.
He barked and gave Vin a look as the helmsman searched for an opening so he could get through the barricade of phaser fire. He could see Vin's eyes fixed on the captain and knew Vin was just as determined to reach Chris Larrabee as he was. Vin was no fool. He guessed what Casey was attempting to do and knew if she succeeded, the bid to retake the bridge would end in failure, and they would be in the same situation as they were when they first entered the room.
I have a plan.
Well, get on with it.
She looked at him with disapproval and wondered what it was about men that made them waste so much time when it was a commodity they could ill afford to waste.
I want you to set your phaser for rapid fire, with a minimal firing gap. I want a continuous volley of energy, keeping the aliens at bay.
Rain knotted her brow in confusion.
But that will only drain my phaser.
That is an order, Lieutenant.
Rain, however, did not need that much convincing. She guessed what he had in mind.
Okay, Commander, since you asked so nicely.
I like her.
Vin grinned and winked at the feisty transporter chief. Ezra ignored the exchange and issued Rain one last piece of instruction.
On my mark.
He ordered and Rain nodded before facing front to fire. Ezra ducked to avoid another blast, hoping this gamble worked. He didn't want to hurt either Mary or Julia, but they had to reach the captain.
Now!
A tremendous barrage of phaser fire exploded from their weapons with such speed that it caught the enemy by surprise. Although they had possession of all the knowledge of the host bodies, Ezra gambled on the aliens needing to access the information first before they could use it. If it were indeed Mary and Julia in control of their bodies, the two women would know instinctively what was required to counter this attack. But as it stood, they forced the aliens to fall back and take cover. Vin Tanner didn't waste any time sprinting forward. Being Vulcan, he was faster and stronger than anyone on the bridge and quickly closed the distance between himself and Chris Larrabee. Vin ran faster than he had ever done in his life, pausing only to see the unconscious form of Alex on the floor as he weaved through the random bolts of phaser fire. Buck and JD were being held back by Casey, who was keeping them pinned using the same tactic Ezra and Rain used to help him reach Chris. Meanwhile, the captain ducked another blast of energy being hurled at him. Chris's ability to fight back was dwindling. Horror ran down his spine when Vin realized the source of Chris's pain was the jagged edge of bone protruding through his flesh. A broken rib had speared through the skin, exposed to the air under his soaked uniform. Chris saw Vin approaching and tried to draw Ax Hala's fire by taking refuge behind the con. Buck, who dealt with Alex a moment ago, was now on the floor unconscious, struck by the stun blast meant to subdue him. JD was pulling the first officer towards his ready room to escape the fire. X-Hala was determined to reach Chris, and she grew more desperate as he continued to evade her. Her people were in trouble, and the only way to deliver them from their imprisonment, as she called it, was to use him as a bargaining point. Whatever the reason, Chris didn't give a damn. He cared about his people too, not just the men on the bridge but the women whose bodies they had stolen. Even though it was sheer agony to move and the blood gushing from the open wound trailed behind him like afterbirth, Chris fought to keep out of her reach. Fortunately, he did not have to do it long because Vin was making his way across the floor, taking advantage of the chaos to reach his captain. Chris slowed down intentionally, distracting X-Hala long enough for Vin to advance. For a few seconds, it worked until X-Hala realized he was making it too easy for her. She whirled around to see Vin appearing before her at the last instant. The Vulcan did not waste time mincing words or offering any warning for her to desist. No sooner than he closed the gap between himself and X-Hala or, by his reckoning, Casey, Vin slammed his elbow square into her face and knocked her out cold. Without uttering a word or a cry of pain, the life seemed to drain out of the woman, and she dropped forward, with Vin catching her before she hit the floor. Vin lowered her onto the deck gently before turning his attention to Chris. "It's about time you got here," Chris drawled as he dropped to the floor, resting with his back against the con, contented not to move because the pain was damn near excruciating.
"We took the long way here."
Vin smiled as he hurried to Chris's side to examine the injury.
"Don't move."
"You can bet your ass on that," the captain muttered, sucking in his breath to control the pain. There was a thin layer of sweat on his skin, and he was going into shock. He needed a doctor, and he needed one immediately.
"The ship?"
Nathan was going to flood the decks with anesthetic gas. "Whatever it is, it's only the women."
"But Rain," Chris remarked, gesturing to the firefight still taking place on the bridge. Vin wanted to help break the deadlock, but he was reluctant to leave Chris when the captain was in such a vulnerable state.
"Something to do with her being Trill,"
Vin responded and looked for a safe place to leave Chris.
"Come on."
He helped Chris to his feet and dragged the captain towards Buck and JD. Movement for Chris was agonizing, but he could appreciate Vin's desire to see him away from the line of fire. Despite his effort to maintain a brave face, a traitorous grunt of pain escaped him as Vin helped him to his feet.
"We have to help them."
Chris groaned again, requiring every ounce of strength to focus on words instead of the pain.
"We will."
Vin was confident Ezra was more than capable of taking care of the last two remaining aliens, at least for the duration it took for him to ensure Chris was out of harm's way.
"But let's get you seen to first."
Unfortunately, Chris was in no position to argue. Ezra was uncertain whose phaser drained first, but in the end, it was the enemy who was facing them without armaments. The momentary advantage did not last long because the effort giving Vin the opening needed to reach Chris placed Ezra and Rain in the same position. The barrage of phaser fire between both camps dwindled, signaling the battle's dying embers. The woman wearing Mary's face made the first move towards them. There was no way she could reach Chris or JD, and even if she did, she'd never get past Vin. Realizing that X-Hala and Alex were also incapable of helping her, Nerida felt the frustration build inside her as their grand plan of vengeance was dead and their freedom was about to be brought to a shattering halt. Whether it was desperation or some frenzied act of defiance struggling to remain alive inside her, Nerida lunged forward first. Before they killed her, she would take the one who betrayed her own kind by rejecting the gift of the many. Rain saw her coming and leapt out of the way when Nerida lunged for her. She rolled out of the way quickly, but the mindset of the one determined to kill her was half mad with berserker rage. The short evasion did not last long, and Nerida recovered Rain's attempt to evade her. She plowed into the trail, toppling them both to the deck and straddling Rain. The transporter chief shielded her face as Nerida pummeled her repeatedly until Rain retaliated by pulling up her knee to slam it into the small of Nerida's back. The alien screeched in pain as she tumbled off Rain, who rolled onto her knees and braced herself high enough to throw a hard swing at her. Her knuckles caught Nerida in the chin, who reeled in pain for little more than a split second before she was up and fighting again. The two women traded blow for blow in a brutal dance of violence that was almost mesmerizing to watch until it became apparent that Nerida had the ruthless savagery to win. She was willing to kill when Rain was not.
"Enough."
Vin stepped into the fray, aiming his gun at Nerida, her arm crushing Rain's throat as blood ran down the transporter chief's face. She glared at him with animalistic menace as she prepared to snap Rain's neck with her bare hands.
"You have no power over me.
I showed you that already, did I not?
Her lips curled into a cruel smile.
You dare not harm me, not I who wear the body of poor little Mary, the captain's whore.
Vin swallowed hard, unable to look at Narita without imagining Mary Travis, his friend and teacher. The woman who helped him understand he was a product of a rich and vast intelligence, not a joke to be branded as an outcast. Even though he set his phaser for stun, Vin could not bring himself to shoot her, even though he knew he simply had to.
Don't make me do it,
he whispered, wondering why it was so hard. There had to be a way to reach her without resorting to violence.
You're weak, as all your kind are weak.
Narita glowered triumphantly and pulled her arm tighter around Rain's throat until the trill was choking and wheezing, her face reddening as she suffocated.
You can't hurt me any more than you can hurt poor Mary, and if you can't...
She lowered her gaze to Rain.
I will kill this abomination for your lack of understanding that Mary is gone. She will never come back.
Suddenly a voice spoke, and it was neither Vin's nor Narita's. It was Chris. Lieutenant Tanner, Chris Larrabee spoke with a voice brittle with ice. Shoot this bitch. Vin pulled the trigger. The bolt of energy struck both women, and Narita crumpled lifelessly on top of Rain, inert and no longer a danger to anyone. When she moved no more, the captain finally succumbed to the attraction of blackness when he eased back against the wall behind him and let the darkness take him. Ezra Standish stood before Sally and knew he did not have to fight her. She lowered her phase rifle when she saw him approach. Amid their plan of taking over the ship and their revenge upon the Daya, she'd forgotten what it was to simply be alive again. All those eons being trapped in a hell no one could imagine, praying for freedom to avenge their suffering, had made them forget the most precious right of all, the right to live as they always wanted.
I will not let this continue,
Ezra said, wondering if the creature who inhabited Julia's body was someone he could have cared for in a different time or place.
I do not wish to harm you, but I will shoot you if you do not surrender now.
You do not need to do that.
She dropped her phaser rifle onto the floor with a soft thud. She swept her gaze over the bridge at the battle they lost, even though Narita refused to give up. However, Sally felt nothing but inner conflict since her encounter with Ezra Standish. The men of this Federation were clearly not like the Daya of her world. When he made love to her, he did so as a man deeply in love with a woman, wanting her to enjoy the experience with him. It was beyond Sally's experience men could behave in this manner, and that one act of passion allowed her to consider perhaps they were different in other ways too. Maybe the ideals of these Federations were precisely what they were, goals to aspire to, not merely the illusion of compassion. It was a sobering thought because if the many were wrong about the Daya of this world on this one thing, could they not be wrong about all of it?
You gave us those 2 minutes, did you not?
Ezra guessed it when he saw her lower her weapon.
You could have had the cargo hold decompress immediately, but you put the sequence in with a 2-minute delay.
I could not turn against my own,
she whispered, her eyes so terribly sad Ezra felt it like a knife in his heart, not because it was Julia's image projecting such pain but the creature who lived inside her body.
But I could not allow you to be harmed. It was not much, but I had hoped you would use the time productively.
Thank you,
Ezra responded, genuinely touched by her act of mercy.
I promise, we will do what we can to help you.
No.
She shook her head and came towards him. Sally raised her hand to his face and touched his cheek. There were tears in her eyes, and Ezra wished he could wipe away all the hurt he knew she must have seen in her life.
It is over.
She kissed him gently.
I do not understand,
he muttered, but inside he knew what she was going to do.
The others may not leave willingly, but I hope you can convince them.
Her tears coming a little more freely down her cheeks as she stared at his pained expression when he saw what was coming.
However, I have a choice, and I will not take from your Julia what the Daya once took from me. Becoming the enemy is something I would die to prevent, and I will.
You do not have to do this.
Yes, I do.
She offered him a slight smile.
Your Julia is a fortunate woman. I will miss you, Ezra. For a short time, you reminded me what it was to live, and I will always be grateful for that. Goodbye.
He wanted to call out to her and tell her to stop what she was doing, but he could not, partly because he wished Julia back and because he didn't even know her name. All Ezra Standish could do was watch as Julia's body became enveloped in a shimmer of bluish light, not unlike the matter stream of a transporter beam, Except this one rose towards the ceiling and disappeared into the bulkhead. Ezra hurried forward when Julia slumped lifelessly to the floor, catching her while still watching that iridescent sparkle of light disappearing into the dark depths of space. Did she still live, or was she dead now? Ezra could not answer, but he would never forget her. Chapter 15. Everywhere. Nathan was unhappy with Chris Larrabee wanting to be present when the aliens in the brig regained consciousness. The doctor, who was most responsible for the retaking of the Maverick through his liberation of engineering and the anesthetic gas pumped throughout the ship, was quick to resume his duties as chief medical officer. With the number of casualties emerging from the bridge after the fighting concluded, Nathan decided he would leave the alien busting to the rest of the senior staff. He had his hands full. Buck suffered severe tracheal bruising like Crane, whom he was very relieved to learn was alive and handled herself well during the fight. Alexandra Stiles needed sedation after her severe battering but was returned to the brig when Nathan finished treating her. The anesthetic gas allowed the male members of the crew to retake the Maverick, but the danger was not over. The women were still under the influence of the many. Until the situation's resolution, they had to be confined under lock and key. Julia Pemberton seemed well, as far as anyone could tell. She remained unconscious after the alien left her body, and tests conducted by Nathan concluded she was merely recovering from the exhaustive process of being host to an alien mind. According to Nathan, Julia would awaken when ready. Although Ezra wanted to stay at her side, he was still chief of security. With Chris determined to face the invaders, Ezra intended to be by his captain's side when the interview convened. Chris was hardly in top form when he entered the brig, although the marvels of modern medical science fixed his broken bones and mended the tear in his flesh. His body still remembered the injury. He remained sore, with aches reminding him most prolifically caution was required. Chris walked into the brig, his steps still somewhat ginger, with Ezra and Vin flanking him since Buck and JD stayed on the bridge to deal with the fallout of the failed invasion. A heavy security contingent remained in the brig, prepared to take extreme measures to prevent trouble. They knew that the aliens had to make contact with a body to possess it. Yet, the crystal kept them from escaping, as Salia demonstrated when she vacated Julia Pemberton's body. It was easy for the aliens in their non-corporeal form to escape the brig, but they would be incapable of doing much else as a shapeless energy form, much less take over the ship. Until Chanya determined how the crystal artifact trapped their minds in space, the prison of flesh and blood would have to do for now.
"I still think this is not a good idea, Captain,"
Ezra stated, mindful of Chris's delicate condition.
"For once, I gotta agree with Ezra. Chris, you don't look like you're in any shape for this."
"Will you two relax?" Chris growled at Vin and then Ezra, refusing to admit they were right. "You sound like a bunch of hens."
Their protest ended abruptly when they reached the cells where the Kuz ringleaders were being held. All three were conscious. Naruto paced the floor like a caged animal while Exhala and the Alex entity sat silently on their beds. Although they could have occupied separate cells, Chris saw no reason for that when the force field prevented them from escaping. The cells in Starfleet brigs were damn near impenetrable, and Chris did not want them to believe they would be treated as they had been by the Daya. Upon seeing him, Naruto hissed at Vin,
"You better pray I do not escape this place, Vulcan, for I will make you pay for this."
Vin wanted to respond but saw Chris's hard stare and held back. The captain reminded himself again that she was not Mary but a vengeful creature prepared to kill all of them if allowed the opportunity.
"If you are done with the posturing, I need to speak with the one of you who is in charge."
Naruto glared at him hatefully.
"I swear to you I will kill this body first before I allow you to have your Mary back."
The malevolence in her voice sent a chill through Vin and Ezra, but Chris remained impassive.
"Not if I do it first," Chris answered firmly and faced Exhala. "You will vacate these bodies immediately and return to your receptacle in the artifact or any other place you wish to go. In either case, this mass possession is over."
"You're mad."
Exhala laughed as she rose to her feet and came towards the edge of the force field so she could look at him directly.
"If we do not choose to leave, you cannot make us go. These bodies are ours. Accustom yourself to that fact, Captain. You will have to kill us to remove us, and I don't think you have the stomach for all those murders on your conscience."
Vin stiffened, his eyes fixed on the Alex entity, and wondered if she knew what they meant to each other. Her indifferent expression said no. He did not know what Chris had in mind, but he knew he wanted Alex back at any cost, no matter his duty to Starfleet. She was worth more than any commission. He was certain Chris felt the same for Mary.
No, I don't have the stomach for that. What I do have, however, is another solution. I won't kill my officers, but you won't get to use their bodies either. I'll stick the entire lot of you into stasis for the rest of their natural lives if I have to. You think being confined to that artifact was bad? You wait until you're trapped in a human body. I'll put you into stasis and then decide whether I'll eject all of you into the nearest singularity I can find. If you've taken their bodies and ended their lives, I swear what possession you have will be brief.
You would not dare.
Ex-Hala exclaimed, her eyes widened with fear, imagining that prison again. Chris leaned closer to the force field and met her eyes with a patented Larrabee glare set for maximum intensity.
Try me, lady. Try me.
He's lying.
Narita shouted, watching the horror sink into Ex-Hala's eyes to realize it was not a threat Chris Larrabee was making to her but a promise of what was to come.
He does not have the stomach to hurt his precious lover. It is only a bluff.
For the first time, the entity inhabiting Alex's body spoke.
Shut up, Narita.
Both captives, and captors, turned to the alien wearing Alex's face. She had remained silent through most of the discussion, observing quietly all that was occurring and trying to reach some conclusion, particularly in the light of Salia's actions.
How dare you?
Narita retaliated when the third member of the group spoke again.
I dare very well, Narita. I also meant it. Be silent and listen.
What is the meaning of this?
Ex-Hala demanded, not wishing to show there was dissension in the ranks.
I am called Callista.
She introduced herself before any of the Federations mistook her for their Alex.
Ex-Hala, I do not wish to speak out of turn, but perhaps we should consider giving them what it is they wish.
Have you lost your mind? Ex-Hala, her brain is just as addled as Salia after her coupling with the First Officer.
Coupling with the First Officer?
Vin shot Chris a look of question. Although he knew nothing that transpired in the last few hours was Alex's fault, Buck was something else altogether. He was about to become infuriated by the idea of Buck giving Alex what he could not when Vin realized the exchange he shared with the creature Narita. Narita used Mary's body against her will, just as Callista must have used Alex's. He had no wish to face Chris with that on his conscience. While he hated the idea, he would not accuse Buck of something he too was not strong enough to resist.
This is not the time, Chris said sharply and hoped it was enough to quell Vin's outrage for the moment.
Unfortunately, Chris doubted there would ever be a time when it would be. Vin seemed to agree and answered with a slight nod as he turned back to Callista, who was about to respond to Narita's claim about her senses.
Ex-Hala.
Callista ignored Narita and continued speaking.
We have spent the last 500,000 years awaiting freedom, all the while plotting our vengeance against those who did this to us. We were on the verge of evolutionary change, and they hastened the process so they could imprison us indefinitely in the artifact. For so long, we envisioned all the terrible things we were going to do to them, but they're dead. Killed no doubt by their folly, with far more efficiency than anything we could ever imagine for them. Although it was not their intention, they did us a kindness.
What?
Ex-Hala looked at Callista as if she were mad.
Kindness?
Yes, Chris lent weight to Callista's argument. You're alive. Although your race is gone, you are all that is left of the Akrin people.
We were Undaya. We were never Akrins.
You were Undaya. Now you are stronger. You're a life form we can't possibly imagine. Don't you understand? Salia figured it out. She understood that without a body, you may not necessarily die. Death is something that comes to a life form trapped in a cellular existence. You are energy, and energy does not die. It transcends into higher states of being.
Don't you see? Ex-Hala, we are free to go anywhere, to do anything we want. Why trap ourselves in these shells of flesh when we are free to roam through the universe like gods? When we were adrift, we saw the wonders of space but could only curse it because we could not explore it. You have led us through our imprisonment.
Callista placed her hand on Ex-Hala's shoulder.
Lead us now through our freedom.
What you ask?
Ex-Hala tried to think of the words, but they would not come because the idea was too incredible.
We could die.
We could.
Callista agreed. She would not deny that.
However, all things die. It is how the universe works, but I do not think we will. I want to go, Ex-Hala. I want to see the things Salia will see before us. You once said we had to be better than deer, that the greatest evil is to become the enemy. If we take these bodies for ourselves, if we steal from these women their futures as ours was once stolen, we will become deer.
I won't be called that.
Nerida gasped, tears welling in her eyes because, though she was afraid and angry, she did not want to be like those who did this to her. That was even too much for her.
I would rather die than become Daya.
Ex-Hala said nothing for a long time as she considered the words spoken to her, realizing Salia, her most trusted lieutenant, her friend for so long, had abandoned them because she was sick of the killing and realized after a while Ex-Hala too, was sick of it. All their lives had been a struggle, a symphony of never-ending pain, lengthened by this terrible thing done to them. Freedom was always some elusive word during their imprisonment, something on which to pin their waning hopes. Now that it was within reach, they were squandering it in a wasteful bid for vengeance against enemies who turned to dust long ago. There was little point in it. Her mind reached throughout the ship, communicating with the many, revealing to them her intention. With even more surprise, she learned the many were not averse to the idea of leaving the body and testing out the limitations of a non-corporeal existence. Trapped in the artifact, there was little chance to explore, but now that the opportunity presented itself, they were rather eager for it. Sometimes, Ex-Hala had to admit, her own people could surprise her.
Captain, it is time we left.
Where will you go? Chris asked, feeling pity for these poor creatures whose actions had a foundation in their terrible suffering. Ex-Hala smiled as her eyes shifted toward the bulkhead, but it was really the stars she was seeing.
Everywhere.
When the many left the ship, it was like nothing anyone had ever seen. Iridescent color glowed in every quarter of the Maverick as the mass exodus began. Crewmen watched in silent wonder as the beams of light moved through the vessel, seeking escape through any means necessary. For a moment, it looked like someone was trying to transport the entire ship as the sparkle of unearthly life made their escape from the cumbersome surroundings of the Maverick. Chris and the others moved to the small window in the brig after the aliens left the women's bodies inside the cell. As they looked into the great expanse of stars beyond the ship, hundreds of sparkling blue clouds converged beyond the hull. For a second, it looked like the formation of a new nebula, radiating so magnificently it was almost blinding.
It is beautiful,
Ezra whispered, remembering how Salia looked when she left Julia.
I hope they make it.
After being told why the many were driven to such actions, Vin felt genuine sympathy for their suffering. I think they have, Chris said, the many's convergences sparkling in his eyes. I think they have. Epilogue.
My first dinner at the captain's table with the senior staff.
Rain grinned as she entered Four Corners for dinner some days later.
I'm moving up in the world.
The atmosphere on the ship was lively, despite the journey to Pacifica being abandoned. The Maverick was required at the frontier immediately because of some minor crisis, and she was the closest ship in the vicinity. Not that anyone minded. Few were eager to do any vacationing after the debauchery preceding the many's invasion of the Maverick. Nathan heard horror stories everywhere from men seduced by women traumatized by the recollection when the aliens departed their bodies. It made him glad he was in the company of the only unaffected female on the ship.
Don't get too excited.
Nathan studied the faces of his friends throughout the room. All appeared to be dealing with the aftermath of the many's possession of the female crew. So far, none of the bridge crew could look each other in the eye.
Neither the senior staff nor the captain are themselves right now.
Hey!
Rain slipped her arm through his and proceeded forward.
If you were them, bonking each other left, right, and center, you'd feel bad too.
Bonking each other?
Nathan shook his head at her choice of words.
What? You prefer doing the wild mamba, the wild thing. Help me out here.
She rattled off a few more lurid descriptions before Nathan finally conceded defeat.
Okay, I get the hint.
They'll be fine.
Rain said confidently as she navigated Four Corners, pausing just long enough to wave at Inez behind the counter. For the first time in weeks since her tragic loss, the bartender emerged from her quarters to take up her duties. She was not exactly as bubbly as she used to be, but Inez returned Rain's friendly wave.
They're embarrassed and a little uncomfortable. With our incredible tact and charm, it's up to us to make them feel better.
God help them.
Still, as he followed Rain towards the captain's table, Nathan had to admit that he really liked this girl.
It never happened, you hear me?
Alexandra Stiles declared as she sat across from Buck, still reeling in humiliation. Why did it have to be Buck Callista seduced? Why not Vin or Chris, hell, even JD? Anything was better than the first officer in the captain's ready room, no less. That was most likely why Chris Larrabee ordered a new desk from Supply. As it was, Alex had trouble stepping into Chris's office without being revisited with images of their heated coupling as he did this, and then she did that, and then they were on top. Oh, this was so humiliating.
Come on, Alex.
Buck wondered what she found so awful about the whole situation. Hell, he enjoyed pleasuring her and felt slightly envious of what Vin would get with both barrels once he could appreciate it.
I know it wasn't you, and I know it meant nothing, but can't we discuss this like adults?
I don't want to be an adult about this. I am humiliated, embarrassed, and appalled at being another notch on your rather long belt.
Hey, I'll have you know I do not have a long belt. Actually, I have a notebook, and you will go in there underneath the heading, Utterly Spectacular.
Oh.
Alex groaned and thudded her head on the table.
I think I'm going to be sick.
She hid her face against the table and drew another smile from Buck, who could not deny he was enjoying this somewhat.
Alex.
He reached for her shoulder, devoid of juvenile smugness.
What?
She grumbled, looking up at him.
I want you to know I realize what happened between us was not your idea, but I don't hate it. Touching you was wonderful. Vin's a lucky man, but I don't want this to hurt our friendship, and I promise you, our friendship means more to me than what we did.
Alex met his gaze, and a slight smile stole across her face when she realized she underestimated him again.
Buck, our friendship means the same to me as it does to you. Even though you'll never let me forget it, I'll live with this.
That's true.
Alex rolled her eyes and added,
because you're still a pig.
Yeah.
He winked at her with a genuinely shit-eating grin.
But I'm a pig that got to fourth base.
Alex groaned and wished the many had taken her with them. Ezra sat across from Julia and could tell she was angry. How could she not be after what happened? He made love to her without even the faintest idea it was an alien possessing her body, not the woman herself. How did he explain that away? Worse yet, he felt something for Salia, who released Julia willingly, unlike the others who took much convincing and threats before they would vacate their hosts. There were no words to describe how muddled the situation was.
Julia,
he said after the long silence between them. She avoided him for days following the many's departure. With their regularly scheduled captain's dinner only a short time away, Ezra finally cornered Julia so they could at least try to talk things out.
We cannot go on like this, please.
Ezra reached across the table and felt encouraged when she did not pull her hand away when he enveloped it with hers.
Talk to me.
Talk to you about what?
She stared, pain etched in every dark fleck in her emerald-colored eyes. She was close to tears but was hiding it valiantly.
You didn't even know it wasn't me.
How could I even guess? You were there, and you wanted me, and I have wanted you ever since you entered my life. Julia, I love you. I loved you since I first saw you, and when you came to me and said you wanted me, I was so happy I didn't think twice.
Julia blinked, and her tears rolled down her cheeks, unable to restrain her sorrow any longer.
I know that, but I still can't help feeling this way. I don't know if I trust you anymore, Ezra. You made love to my body, but it wasn't me. I wanted our first time together to be special, to mean something, and now I don't know what to think.
She rose abruptly to her feet, unable to remain without weeping.
Julia, please, do not leave it like this.
He would have begged if he thought it would have done the slightest bit of good, but instinct told him it was futile.
I need time, Ezra.
She pulled away from him, and Ezra knew then that he would not convince her, not today anyway.
I just need time. Tell the captain I'm sorry, I'm not feeling well.
With that, Julia hurried out of Four Corners, taking the broken pieces of Ezra's heart with her. Vin was glad Chris had yet to arrive at the captain's table. Like the rest of his comrades, the aftershocks of the many also affected Vin. As much as he hated the invasion into his mind by Nerida, he also found what he saw of Mary's life tantalizing. Over the past few days, he secretly observed the lovely blonde, wondering how it was she could remain so composed and sedate around Chris Larrabee when he saw how hot the passion inside her could burn. Until that exchange between them inside his quarters, Vin did not know how much difference could be in the simple biological functions between humans and Vulcans. When she touched his mind and showed him the sublime ecstasy of lovemaking, Vin thought the overpowering sensations would end him. Since that day, he replayed the memory of being touched that way while sharing the experience in one's mind. How would it feel to touch Alex in that manner, run his fingers over her skin and bask in the sensual pleasure of her body? He wanted so badly to feel it, but Vin was a boat adrift in the water by a shore that was maddeningly out of reach. As Mary sat across from him, she could not meet his gaze, even though no one else was at the table. The others were still engaged in conversations throughout the mess hall, just as awkward. Alex and Buck talking sent a pang of jealousy through Vin. Buck had been with Alex in a way Vin could not be, and while he felt anger, he could not hate Buck. Not when he was guilty too.
Mary,
Vin spoke up and saw her raise her eyes to his face reluctantly.
Does it really feel like that?
Mary's cheeks reddened, but she answered him because his question was one of genuine curiosity.
Yes, that's how it felt.
You must have loved him very much.
The love he felt between Mary and her husband burned like the heat of hot Vulcan sand. He never thought normal Vulcans who subscribed to Kathia could feel that way.
I did.
She nodded a bittersweet smile, sorrow replacing the awkwardness.
I still feel him inside my head, and sometimes I almost think he's still alive until I remember that he's not.
And you love Chris that way too?
Vin asked, hoping he was not intruding. Now her smile was not bittersweet but warm and inviting. The question in the past was hard to answer, but when Vin asked her so pointedly, it was hard to deny.
Yes, I do. It's different from what I felt for Sion, but no less powerful.
He's a lucky man.
The Vulcan remarked as he saw Chris entering Four Corners and hastily added before the captain reached his table.
I hope someday I'm that lucky. Thank you for showing me what it could be like, Mary. I know you're sorry it happened, but I'm not. I have something to look forward to now.
Since this all began and ended, Mary found she could look him in the eye.
It's worth waiting for Vin. I'll be fine.
She confessed after a moment.
I'm a little confused about it all, but I'll be fine.
I'm glad,
Vin said, pleased they had reached something of an understanding.
However, if you don't mind, I don't think I'll be needing any lessons for a while.
Mary gave him a look.
No kidding.
Chris entered Four Corners about the same time as Josiah Sanchez. As he paused at the main entrance of the popular recreational facility, he allowed his gaze to sweep across the room to see if the rest of the senior staff were already present. JD and Casey were at the far end of the room, and when the yeoman sighted him, looked ready to dive under the table. The young Bajoran still could not form any coherent sentence around him that did not include the words, "I think I'm going to die, and you are old enough to be my father." Chris would have been insulted if he wasn't so thrilled things were back to normal. Fortunately, JD found the whole thing rather amusing. Perhaps because the boy was too idealistic to know some men would put aside friendship and honor for the attentions of a lady. Whatever the reason, Chris was grateful JD maintained a sense of humor about the situation because Casey needed to see it in the same way too. Besides, there was no way Chris was getting rid of her as his yeoman. Her coffee was to die for. The fallout of the many on board left numerous relationships in shambles. Chris only had to see Buck and Alex making their way to the captain's table to be reminded of that fact. The science officer was swatting Buck across the shoulder, no doubt in response to some tasteless remark about their tryst. On that thought, Chris reminded himself to have his old desk ejected into space. Ezra Standish was alone, and judging by the stony expression on his face, Chris guessed he was hiding a great deal of pain under that seemingly indifferent facade. The captain would have offered words of comfort, but Ezra was intensely private and would not appreciate the effort. The security chief noticed the time and rose to his feet to join the captain's table. Rain and Nathan were the only ones present who were at ease. Despite the newness of their relationship, the warmth between them told Chris that Rain was here to stay. Chris was glad. Nathan needed someone in his life. Besides, he liked her. Vin and Mary seemed to have resolved whatever tension existed between them. He knew something had gone on, and though it was nothing like what transpired between Buck and Alex, it caused them similar discomfort. Chris felt no jealousy. His best friend loved Alexandra Stiles. He also knew Mary would never consciously betray him, and it was best that he not know what happened between Vin and Mary. Chris valued the relationships he had with both more than satisfying his curiosity. It was best to let sleeping dogs lie.
Oh.
You know something, Josiah? Chris let out a sigh as they resumed walking towards his table. Josiah was in a good mood because he received a reprieve from the affections of Audrey King, considering what had transpired between them during the recent invasion. The lady was so mortified by her failed seduction that she decided to keep her distance for now. It was just what Josiah needed to determine how he felt about her and whether he was ready to date again.
"What, Chris?"
he asked, noticing the same amount of emotional turbulence at the captain's table.
"Boy, do you have your work cut out for you?"
The end. Thank you for listening to Weaker, a Star Trek Maverick adventure. As always, this is for my fellow M7 fans, and thanks to Nancy for creating this universe.